Today is Friday, January 31st, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. Coming up, almost 3 years after the Brexit vote, Britain leaves the European Union today.
This is a momentous change for Britain, and nobody really knows in which direction it's going to go.
Plus, the deadliest day yet for the novel coronavirus outbreak in China. And we hear from Palestinians and Israelis in the West Bank about the U.S. plan for the region. Those stories and more are next. Our top story today, after more than 3 years, Brexit is here. What does it mean for Britain? To find out, I spoke to VOA's Henry Ridgewell in London earlier today.
Brexit officially happens at midnight tonight, Brussels time, which is, of course, 11 o'clock in the evening, London time, and that is when there is no going back for the UK. Up until that point, Britain had been able to send a letter to Brussels to say, we want to stop it all, we want to stay in the EU, and they would have been able to do so. But after this point, it's officially out. And after 11 o'clock this evening, London time, it enters what's known as the transition period, which currently lasts until the end of the year, and essentially not much changes in the next 11 months. Trade rules, laws, everything like that, passports stay the same. The next big moment will come later this year when it's decided whether to extend that transition period. Many people you speak to in Europe say there's no chance we can finalize any trade deals or arrangements in that short time frame. Britain is saying it must be completed in that time frame because we're not going to extend it. So it looks like there is another clash on the horizon.
Brexit has dragged on for a while. The original vote was more than 3 years ago, but really this is just the beginning. What does it look like going forward? How long until we actually see Brexit finalized, so to speak?
That's a very difficult question to answer, and it really depends on the mood and the momentum and the progress of those talks over the coming months and years. As you say, Brexit feels like it's gone on for a very long time. It has, 3.5 years since that referendum in June 2016. But all of those deliberations have been about the withdrawal agreement, basically the divorce, simplifying the leaving process, and now they've got to decide how they get on in the future. Britain's point of view is that it is already in perfect alignment with the European Union because up until 11 o'clock it is still a member, so it should be easy to change a few aspects of the relationship and get a pretty quick trade deal. That at least is Boris Johnson's rhetoric. The problem is he has said he doesn't want a close relationship with Europe. He doesn't want to be bound by any European laws. No jurisdiction for the European Court of Justice in Britain. He wants different trading standards, different social standards, environmental and labor laws, and so on, to enable Britain to become more sovereign, as he puts it, but also perhaps to try to become more competitive. And so that is a lot of new legislation to be worked out. And Europe's biggest fear is that by changing those laws, by undercutting Europe on things like environmental standards or labor laws, then Britain will become more competitive than the European bloc, and then it will have a powerful competitive neighbor that it may struggle to deal with. So Europe's desire is actually to use its leverage to keep Britain closely aligned and to say to London, you won't get access to our single market. You will have to pay high tariffs to trade with us unless you keep these what they call a level playing field on all these kind of standards.
The Brexit debate has bitterly divided the British public. What's the mood like there today? Is it celebratory? Is it mourning? Is it a mix of the two?
It's certainly a mix of the two. It's a typical winter's day here, cold, drizzling, raining. Despite that, Brexiteers will celebrate this evening in central London, led by Nigel Farage, the member of the European Parliament, who has really been at the forefront of the Leaving Europe campaign for decades now. There is a sense of achievement and a milestone among Brexit campaigners And so for them, I think it is a very celebratory mood. But as you say, the country is hugely divided. Most opinion polls, in fact, every single opinion poll really in the last couple of years has shown that a slim majority of the British public actually would prefer to stay in the European Union. There are many passionate supporters of Britain's European Union membership, and for them, it is a huge sense of loss and regret and of mourning, of losing what they feel is an identity, a European identity, but also more practical issues in terms of they will lose the right to live and to work across the continent as of the end of the transition period. And so this is a momentous change for Britain, and nobody really knows in which direction it's going to go.
That was VOA's Henry Ridgewell in London. But it's not just the British who Brexit will affect. So to get the pulse of ordinary Europeans, journalist Lisa Bryant spoke with people in Paris, France, and filed this report for VOA.
Brexit may be causing a political earthquake in Brussels, but it's hard to feel many aftershocks here in Paris.
Unfortunately, I don't have the time to think about it because of my job and all the things that are happening within our countries as well.
French businesswoman Marielle Masson once worked in London, but it's hard for her to connect with Brexit back home.
I don't really follow up the news regarding the Brexit, so I have no clue what to think about it.
French and other Europeans have their own issues to deal with. Protracted protests here against pension reforms, the spread of coronavirus from China.
Well, I think the first feeling that Europeans feel about Brexit, it's very sadness. Sadness because it's really the end of something.
Analyst Elvire Fabry works at the Jacques Delors Institute, named after a former French European Commission president. Along with sadness, she says, many Europeans feel something else.
Public opinion is really watching at Brexit with a sort of fatigue, not the same fatigue as the one that the British public opinion is feeling itself.
And it's true, Brexit, with its diplomatic squabbles and delayed deadlines, has seemed never-ending. But as the European Union and Britain begin talks about their future relationship, there are many unknowns. Will European farmers and fishermen lose business after Brexit? Will European shippers be stuck in unending custom lines to reach Britain? That's a concern for French truck driver Pierre Villard, who travels to Britain frequently.
Puisque je suis dans le transport aussi, on se pose la question, c'est avec la douane.
Villard says he fears a massive backup of trucks using the Channel Tunnel. While France launched Brexit custom tests last year, he says nobody knows what will happen when it becomes a reality.
J'ai des amis et de la famille en Angleterre et ça me dérangerait d'être...
Adolphine Simba, who has been shopping at Britain's M&S food store here, says she's worried she might have to apply for a visa to visit friends and family in Britain.
Siamo pronti, relazione Verostat, per appello nominale.
Brexit is also sparking soul-searching among some in the European Parliament, which voted Wednesday to formally approve Britain's departure. Greens Party lawmaker Philippe Lambert from Belgium suggests it is failing ordinary people.
We European decision-makers must realize that if an increasing number of our fellow citizens have turned their backs against the European project is for a reason.
Anti-European parties gained ground in EU Parliament elections last year, but turnout was generally at a record high. And polls show public support for the EU is on the rise.
Déjà l'euro, enfin plusieurs pays, du coup plus de force.
Truck driver Villard likes the euro currency and says he believes the EU generally strengthens Europe. For their part, populist lawmakers are toning down their rhetoric about a French-style Frexit or an Italexit in Italy.
All the parties that are really critical towards the EU have switched a little the wording and their strategy. Instead of calling for a similar move out from the EU, now they tend to they want to change the EU from the inside.
Some see Brexit as a major defeat for the EU, but it is also giving some of its citizens and these EU lawmakers who sang goodbye to Britain in Brussels a chance to reconsider the strengths of a united Europe. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
For more on Brexit, we now go live to Joel Richard Paul, a professor at the University of California, Hastings in San Francisco. Hello, Joel. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
So we've seen how over the next 11-month transitional period, there might not be any legal changes, perhaps, but surely businesses in the UK or businesses who deal with the UK will be making preparations for what might happen after that. So what kind of changes might we see or impacts on Britain's economy over the next 11 months or so?
Well, this is the really troubling aspect of Brexit. We have created a situation in which there is so much uncertainty about the kind of agreement that may be reached, if any agreement is reached, between Britain and the European Union in the next 11 months. And because of that, capital disdains any uncertainty. And so we see tremendous loss of investment that's already occurring in the United Kingdom. The Harvard Business Review surveyed hundreds of businesses in the UK and found that people were reducing the amount of their investments there. We've lost about 150,000 European residents now already in the UK, which is tending to contribute to an economic slowdown. The growth rate has already slowed from a 1.6% annual rate to about 1% annual rate of the gross domestic product. And we've seen that the pound has lost considerable value relative to the euro. These kinds of measures are likely to contribute to an investment environment in which many businesses will choose to go elsewhere. And, of course, many businesses have already chosen to go. This may be to the advantage of Dublin and Paris and Frankfurt, but it's certainly going to hurt employment in the UK. And I think that there's a genuine risk that with the falling pound contributing to inflation and a loss of investment tending to lower economic growth, that what you can see in the UK is maybe a long period of stagflation.
And now looking at the EU, you mentioned that it could actually help with investment moving from Britain to EU member states, but could there also be blowback on the EU or suffering in terms of the economy of the EU itself?
Well, yes, of course, because just as 45% of Britain's exports are going to the EU, a very substantial portion of EU's exports are going to Britain, and there may be a loss of access to that market. There's also just the effects on the politics of the EU that I think are really disturbing. Britain contributes about 15% of the budget of the European Union, and there are, of course, nationalist populist parties in other parts of Europe, in Italy and in France and elsewhere, that have also talked about possibly leaving the European Union, and they're sort of looking at the British example, and if things go poorly in Britain, ironically, it might be good for the EU because it might mean that those populist parties will lose strength. On the other hand, if the British are doing not too badly, those populist parties may press their case for leaving the EU.
Got it. So, thank you very much. That was law professor Joel Richard Paul of the University of California, Hastings in San Francisco. Thanks so much for coming on the show, Joel.
Thanks for having me.
The Australian capital region declared a state of emergency on Friday because of an out-of-control forest fire burning erratically to its south. It's the first fire emergency for the area since 2003, when wildfires killed four people and destroyed almost 500 homes in a single day. And in India, the hanging of four men scheduled for Saturday for a notorious gang rape and murder on a Delhi bus in 2012 has been postponed, a court ruled Friday, delaying what may be India's first execution since 2015. The brutal attack on Jyoti Singh sparked weeks of demonstrations and shined a spotlight on the alarming rates of sexual violence against women in India. And in the U.S., senators are expected to vote in the next few hours on whether to call witnesses in the impeachment trial of President Donald Trump. And also in the U.S., presidential candidates prepare for a last weekend of campaigning before voting begins for who will be the Democratic Party nominee against Trump. The state of Iowa will be the first to hold caucuses to select a nominee on Monday, followed by the rest of the U.S. states over the next few months. You're listening to VOA News.
The weekend is here. That means another chance to tune in to Music Time in Africa. Hello, everybody. I'm Heather Maxwell. I will take you on an exciting journey of music from Algeria to South Africa, from Nigeria to Kenya, and from yesteryear to today. I also have an exclusive interview with Dutch Moroccan group Samira's Blues. Breaking news about who is performing at the American Super Bowl halftime show. And a song of the week that brings plenty of lively discussion about the Grammy Awards. You can't miss this one. Join me this Sunday at 15:05 and 20:05 Universal Time.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. In China, 43 people died Friday from the novel coronavirus, the most in a single day so far in the two-month outbreak. And new cases have been found in Russia, the United Arab Emirates, and in Europe. This comes after the World Health Organization on Thursday declared the outbreak a global health emergency. The World Health Organization said regular hand washing and reporting suspected cases to health authorities is the best way to halt the disease's spread, and did not recommend any travel restrictions on China. Even so, the U.S., Japan, Britain, and Germany have warned their citizens against traveling to China, while Singapore, Mongolia, and Vietnam have taken steps to bar Chinese visitors. Pakistan, Rwanda, Kenya, and Morocco are a few of the nations where some flights to China have been suspended, either out of health concerns or because there aren't enough passengers. Meanwhile, numerous countries have evacuated their citizens from the Chinese city Wuhan, where the outbreak started. The first plane load of French evacuees arrived Friday at a military base near Versailles. International Edition editor Kate Pound-Dawson spoke to journalist Nicolas Pinault in Paris for more.
What's interesting here in France is that French authorities, they just confirmed a sixth case. And what's interesting is that the sixth case is a doctor who treated a patient who then traveled to Asia. So it's a human-to-human contamination, which is new in France right now, because most of the time we had the five previous cases, they were imported cases. So this is the first one that actually has been contaminated in France through someone who traveled to Asia. So the total is six now in France, coronavirus cases. But we have to say that right now all of them are still at the hospital, and so far they're still alive.
The French government has begun evacuating French citizens. A flight arrives today from China with evacuees. What's going to be the procedure for these evacuees? Do they just go home, or is there a plan to have them wait out a quarantine period?
No, so right now what you have 200 people arriving from China. They're going to land in a military airport near Marseille, southern France. And what's going to happen is that they're going to be transferred directly to a vacation center that has been transformed to have them staying for 2 weeks with no contact with outside world. They're going to stay there. It's very important to mention that among these 200 passengers, none of them has the virus. None of them are showing sign of the virus. It's just, you know, to be cautious with them. And they didn't want to stay in Wuhan with the Chinese quarantine operation. They wanted to have this operation going on in France. So they're going to be transferred over there. They will have no contact with the outside world. And it's important to notice that this arrival has created some tension and some fear in the neighborhood. The name of the small town is Carry-le-Rouet, which is very close to Marseille. It's a small city. And the residents, the inhabitants of the people living near the vacation center when they're going to stay, they're going to have a meeting with the French health minister, because a lot of them, they're criticizing the decision to have them going to a vacation center instead of staying at hotel, you know, to monitor the situation. And that's the situation this Friday right now in France.
Now, overall in Europe, how are governments and people reacting to the viruses? We have new cases, not just in France, but in Italy and places like that.
Well, fear is growing, but it's very important to mention that health authorities, they keep stressing the fact that this coronavirus right now is less deadly than the seasonal flu. For example, in France, you have 10,000 people dying each year from the regular flu. So they're trying to be cautious in the message that, okay, we need to take measures and we need to make sure that no more cases developed in Europe. But we also have to keep in mind that this virus is, for example, less deadly than what you have in the SARS epidemic back in 2003. Also, it is important to mention that many airline companies have suspended their flights, or they reduced the capacity to travel to China, to and from China to Europe.
That was journalist Nicolas Pineau in Paris, speaking to International Edition's Kate Pound-Dawson. President Donald Trump's controversial plan for Israel and Palestine includes the Israeli annexation of the Jordan Valley, which comprises almost a third of the West Bank along the Jordan border and is one of the world's main sources of dates. For VOA, journalist Linda Gradstein spoke to both Israelis and Palestinians in the Jordan Valley to get their reactions to what Trump has called the, quote, deal of the century, end quote. This is Orit Artzieli, an Israeli settler from the Jordan Valley Regional Council.
For us, it's very good because all the area of the Jordan Valley, it's a strip, 80 kilometers by length. Will be under the sovereignty. And that means the law of Israel will be here and not anymore by army. Now it's by the army, and the army doesn't know to deal with citizens. Only the government know how to deal with citizens. So we prefer that we will be part of the Israel country.
About 25,000 Palestinians live in the city of Jericho, which is under the sole control of the Palestinian Authority. They are concerned that Jericho could be cut off from the rest of the West Bank if Israel annexes the Jordan Valley. Here's Jericho Mayor Salim Groof.
Both as Palestinians and as Arabs, we completely reject Trump's deal of the century. The plan means Israel takes even more land than it did in 1967.
Despite the surrounding political tensions, Israeli farmers in the Jordan Valley say there is peaceful coexistence with their Palestinian workers and neighbors. Israeli farm owner Kuki Elbaz.
Ordinary people in this area, most of the Arabs that live here, they are farmers as well. And the workers that come to just put bread and milk on their table.
Elbaz's Palestinian workers agree that relations here are good, but they worry about the future if Israel takes the land. Hosni Tarek, a Palestinian farm worker, had this to say.
I am worried. Will I need a permit to come here? What if I don't pass a security check? I will need to find another job.
Palestinian date farm owners are also worried. Ismail Daik, a former Palestinian Minister of Agriculture, owns one farm and its adjoining factory. Two-thirds of his 80,000 date trees are located in areas that could be annexed by Israel.
It's a peaceful area. We have no problems and things. Now I am expecting the problems will start. When it's forbidden for you to go to your field, they will take everything. They decided to take the land, the water, everything. The things will change.
Those were voices of people from the West Bank. That's it for us today. You've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. Thanks to our director, Nadia Taha, and engineer, PJ Elliott. I'm Jason Patinkin. Have a good night.